clouds of red, moon rising on the Cuyahoga River.
It's lights out and away we go.
To the lake.
What a match day this was.
Moon rising on the Cuyahoga River. Rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River. Rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River. Rolling into Cleveland to the lake. Cleveland, city of light, city of magic. Cleveland, city of light, you're calling me.
Podcasting from Studio 2520. Somewhere near Cleveland, Ohio.
Cause the Cuyahoga River goes smoking through my dreams.
And live.
Big river.
Via the paid subscription of Zencaster, the campus of Otterbein University. This is Tackling the Chicane on opening day.
Lord,
as much as it pains me to say, let's go, guards.
Lord can make you turn. Lord can make you overflow. Lord can make you burn. Burn on.
Randy Newman.
Burn on.
The opening credits of one of the greatest Major League Baseball movies ever made that makes us all a little sad. our beloved Cleveland Indians / Guardians, who hold a high place in our hearts, but not so much with going to the big dance and winning the show. So.
Yeah, I in preparation for this season, I like to go on YouTube and watch back some of my favorite Indians / Guardians moments that I've witnessed. I had the Oscar Gonzalez walk-off against the Yankees in 2022 in rotation. I always go back to the Rajay Davis game-tying home run in Game 7 of the World Series. Of course, we know how that one ended up, but for one fleeting moment, Cleveland was on top of the world. And if you could just bottle that feeling, you'd be a millionaire if you sold it.
I distinctly remember sitting right here in what was to become Studio 2520 on that seventh game with a two-hour rain delay.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking there's no way we can lose. And yet we did.
That is sort of the way it goes as a Cleveland baseball fan. Of course, you have about, I don't know, let's just say more experience than even I do with that heartbreak that comes with being a Cleveland sports fan. But Maybe, just maybe, this is the year.
In our lifetime, maybe.
Yeah.
Let's hope. Major renos going on at the stadium. About 80% complete right now, but more right field district-esque. I think they're going to mimic that in the left field. And so open air standing seating, reno to the club restaurant, which needed something to be done. So yeah, I'm looking forward. I hope we can catch a game this summer. All the seats were replaced.
Yeah, I did. So see yeah, that.
It should be a nice refresh to the Jake, as I still like to refer to it. Progressive Field now, but yeah, hard to believe that 30 years on since they built that particular venue. So you weren't not even a blink in the eye of me in 95 when they went to the series and an expansion team crushed them.
Yeah, 95 and 97. But who's counting? Right. Yeah. But yeah, we've had that 2016 run and then a couple good playoff runs since. Let's, I don't know, opening night for us against the A's. So we'll see. We'll see. Always cling to hope. It's all you can do.
Right.
But let's shift into gear here for this episode, which should give us quite a bit to talk about. If you have been living under a rock recently, then you probably would not have known that the Australian Grand Prix, which historically is usually offering some curveballs for us, did once again, and we'll get into that, 'cause there is a lot of stuff going on here. So that, of course, was fantastic, and we'll dive into that. On the soccer side of things, the United States and Mexico, another chapter in that rivalry in the CONCACAF Nations League. Anytime those two teams match up, there's always some sort of drama and excitement. So we will get into that on the back half of the show. Producers are telling me we are being quizzed today as well, so there will be that as well.
Yes, so we will partake in the This Week in F1. Apparently this is a new thing that they're doing, where they'll have a quiz after each subsequent race, and we will partake in that. It is a timed venture, so we'll see how we do. We have 18 minutes to answer 10 questions.
Okay. Well, I look forward to doing that. But in the meantime, we need to dive in to what was the 2024 Australian Grand Prix. And let's just address the elephant in the room. Max Verstappen does not win this race.
Yeah, so I guess what we all need to remember as F1 fans is these are mechanical bits of machinery that, regardless of your budget and or your dominance in the series, things happen and made the race quite enjoyable, actually, for those of us who would like to see any outcome other than the norm. And we had it this time. We had a really good GP in Australia. And if that means taking Max out of the equation, then so be it. They had a right rear brake failure. And basically, from the launch, you kind of have to think about the systems in these cars when they take off. When lights out goes, the cars have a very specific cadence mechanically and electronically that has to happen. And apparently, the right rear stuck on the Red Bull car. And catastrophically failed just a lap into the race. So, yeah, after that, then we had a really good GP. So,
yeah, it was. So, and I knew at the time it was a long time since this has happened, but literally something that has not happened in not only 2024, but it didn't happen at all in 2023. Max Verstappen not finishing a race. So he had not had a wreck or any sort of mechanical failure since the 2022 season.
Yeah, 42 consecutive finishes for him, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so it kind of is what it is. This race was really interesting. I think everybody started on softs, and we had a lot of pit action early in the race for everyone to go to hards.
Mm-hmm.
Piastri and Ferrari, they pitted fairly early, just a few laps in. Norris and Perez pitted lap 15 to take on their hard tires. And then another kind of ghost in the machine, lap 17, Hamilton has a power unit failure. And he was pretty much, not pretty much, he was finished. So,
yeah.
Made for a pretty interesting race after that. I think it should be noted that Haas has had a bit of good luck lately.
Two cars
finishing the points.
Yeah, I'm
mostly because of penalty kind of jockeyed the positions around a bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, so 9 and 10, I think, right?
Yeah, double points day, first double points day since 2022 for them. That was when Mick Schumacher was still in the car. I am a little bit maybe more high on Haas now, maybe even than you here, just because that car looks competitive. So listeners can go back 3 episodes ago when both of us were pretty low on that, and I predicted them to finish last, and I'm starting to wonder if that was a mistake, because this car looks competitive. Hulkenberg is dialed in. I mean, he's dialed in, qualifies well, but his racecraft has been very good. Magnussen is just a pit bull. He's the guy you want driving a Haas, basically. He is hard to pass. He's annoying to other teams, and he's a team player. You know, so for Haas, he's kind of the dream package.
Yeah, for sure. And look, let's just keep this up and let's scrap for the 2 and 3 point positions so that at the end of this campaign, we can get, a decent constructor's finish for mm-hmm. Haas.
Yeah.
That's really what it's all about. And points are gold bars in this series. So, just keep doing what they're doing. And, let's say a podium for Haas this year would be huge. It's a long shot, but at this point, let's just try to make our mark in the constructor's standings.
Yeah.
As the most underfunded, smallest, bastardized team in F1. Let's see what we can do.
The thing is, and I didn't expect this to be the case, but this is how it's played out in 3 races. There are 2 teams at least that I would say without a doubt are worse than Haas at the moment, those being Sauber and Alpine Alpine, little better this time around, I'll admit. But Sauber, oh my God, are they a dumpster fire right now? Is this the worst pit crew ever assembled? It seems like it. Three straight weeks where they have had a horrible pit stop, and it totally ruined Bottas's race.
Yeah, let's consider the fact that anything over 3 seconds is considered a failure.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a tire change stop, but still, for those who are in tune watchers of these races and are paying attention, there's a lot of stuff that has to happen when that car comes in the box. It's still a manual jack that goes in the front of the car, which is a kind of a big deal. And then, you know, you've basically got to shuttle get four tires mounted and, you know, secured. And the fact that some of these teams can do that in a 2.5 second range is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
So when a team like Kick Sauber is having trouble, I don't think it's because they don't have the skill set. I just think that it's really hard.
Yeah. It feels like there's the pressure that you feel. Some of those guys just don't seem to be reacting all too well to that. And the performance of the car has been basically non-existent as well. So that's just something I didn't expect much from that team, but they're somehow going less than what I thought they would. I think, you know, we do need to at least touch on, you know, the winner of this race here in Carlos Sainz for Ferrari, coming off that appendix debacle in Saudi Arabia where we saw Oliver Bearman fill in for him. And just 2 weeks later, he's winning a Formula One race. Of course, it helps when Max Verstappen doesn't finish. But after that, dominant from Sainz. Dominant. I mean, not really tested by anyone. There is that concept of, you know, team management there. I'm pretty sure Leclerc was told not to push him too hard just because you're trying to maximize points and get that 1-2. But Carlos Sainz, reminder people, does not have a seat next year right now. Looks like, without a doubt, the second best driver in the series at the moment.
Yeah, I guess if I had to fantasize about where Sainz might land, there's been rumblings about Aston Martin potentially. But then you're not going to unseat Stroll because of Papa.
Yeah.
So where does Alonso go? Does Alonso retire after this year? Or does Sainz potentially look for a seat at Mercedes?
Yeah.
Potentially. I don't
know. Audi's in the picture looming.
Yeah. It's pretty early. And I think what we're going to see is maybe a short stint for a couple of positions in 2025 before everything changes the year after.
Yeah.
So, other than that, just an entertaining race to watch. It should be, we have to kind of talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the Williams camp.
Yeah, I was getting ready to mention that, but go ahead.
Yeah, unable to procure a spare chassis. And in the light of not having an extra car, basically booted a driver and said, well, we're going to put this particular fellow behind the wheel. So they're just a talk about a dumpster fire. I mean, so here's what I'm going to say about that. All of the shit that Andretti Autosport has taken just trying to get into the series, And we have an, a well-established team who, for whatever reason, did not have a spare chassis.
Yeah.
That seems a little bit not cool.
I don't understand how you go into a Formula One season with a team that has a decent amount of cash that Williams does, and you have two functioning chassis of which you have two drivers. So you know if something were to happen, you just did. Who approved that? Who was like, yep, that'll be fine. Yeah, no one's going to wreck.
We don't need the third chassis. We're good.
I don't get that at all. And then, look, I understand it is a cutthroat business and you need to maximize your opportunities to score points. So I just want to say, preamble, everyone in the world knows that Alex Albon is a better driver than Logan Sargeant. However, the fact that Alex Albon gets to crash his car in a session and then you turn around and say, well, Logan, we're going to need your car. You're not racing because your teammate just crashed his. I don't care in what I don't care if Max Verstappen was Logan Sargeant's teammate. I don't care. He crashed the car. You're fucking out of luck, buddy. Because what damage is that going to do to Logan Sargeant, who we know is feeling the pressure of trying to keep a seat? Because
yeah, it didn't seem like the right call. And there's some articles on F1 about that. Totally agree with you with the fact that this was not a good play on their part. It was a desperation play.
Yeah.
And they don't. So as you said, you have no faith. You have no faith in Logan Sargeant to the point mm-hmm. where you're just going to tell him, sorry, guy. You didn't fuck up. The other guy did, but you know what? We're going to put him in the last remaining chassis that we have because we really think that he can bring a better result. That's a kick in the pants.
Yeah.
What a huge kick in the pants.
What does Logan Sargeant think? Seriously. I mean, you get your bullshit PR statement that he puts out, but he has to have been livid. I mean, how? So, like you said, your team basically just went, yeah, we don't think you can do anything. So then why are you even here? You know, why are you even in the seat? Why does the team pay you? I mean, it's just, I don't understand the logic at all. I don't know. You have to feel pretty bad for him at this point because how is he supposed to have any confidence in his ability now?
Right. Yeah. So before we get into the standings here, I've got to jet over to the right here for 1 second here. Just hang tight with me.
Okay. Fill. I will do some filler because I actually would just like to point out a few things that happened within the race. Basically, you have quite a bit of team orders going on. We already mentioned Charles Leclerc pretty much being told not to push on Sainz, which is very, very acceptable for me, at least. When Ferrari are trying to do everything they can to at least make the Constructors' Championship somewhat interesting. You got that as well in the McLaren camp. The hometown hero and Oscar Piastri told to move out of the way for Lando Norris. Lando definitely had more pace. He ends up finishing on the podium in this one. Good scrap again between K-Mag and Albon. Eventually K-Mag, as we know, gets the better of him there. Albon and K-Mag don't seem to get along all that well. That's not the first time we've seen them involved in a little scuffle. But I have to side with K-Mag here because I respect a guy who drives hard. And then just to compound on the bad day for Mercedes after Hamilton retires, the final lap of the race, George Russell junks his car basically and then blames Alonso for double braking or some bullshit.
Yeah, it was it wasn't that horrifying of a crash. It was through the gravel against the wall and then just tore the car to shreds. I did get to listen to the full radio call on Instagram today, and Russell was terrified being half rolled over in the middle of the track that somebody was going to plow into him.
Really?
He called several times back to the race engineer to red flag, red flag, red flag, because I think he thought he was going to get hit again.
Yeah.
But yeah, just completely destroyed the car.
Yeah.
Suspension. I'm not sure exactly what happened. You couldn't really tell. I think he just pushed a little too hard and he basically lost it and into the wall and then back, kind of carom back, and then there was nothing left of the suspension on the car, so he kind of half rolled over, but he was still upright.
Yeah.
He was terrified.
I you know, the crash is what it is. It's just maybe if you're Mercedes, a slightly worrying trend, because George Russell does have these mistakes in him. Ironically, the last time Sainz won in Singapore, he did the same thing, crashing his car like on the last lap. So just something to pay attention to, because it does seem like sometimes George Russell is a guy that has a mistake in him, I will say. But huge implications, as we'll get into right now, on those standings, because Mercedes end with 0 points in McLaren, podium in a fourth place, so they're loving that result.
Yeah, McLaren had a really good outing.
And
I think we talked about this last year, threat for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Both McLaren cars could be a threat this year as well. So lots of good stuff happening. And even if that, you know, has to be on the back of a mechanical failure, I'll take it. That's what this series is kind of all about. And, my prediction is that Max will be second or third, possibly, in one of these races this year again, just mm-hmm. because.
Yeah.
I don't have any scientific evidence that that's going to happen, but it's just kind of the law of averages.
Yeah. I think you'll probably see a couple more races where he doesn't win. Eventually, you know, this was going to happen. I mean, you can't run forever without DNFing, but you wonder if he'll end up in a tangle or something sometime this season as well.
Yeah. So let's look at driver standings after the first three races of the season here. Obviously, we've got Verstappen on top with 51. Leclerc close behind at 47 points. Perez at 46. So there's a 1 point differential between two and three. And then Carlos Sainz in number four position at 40 points. And then it kind of dips off pretty severely after that. Piastri with 28 in position 5. And Lando Norris just 1 point behind with 27 points. And then I guess we'll just go through the top 10 here. Russell at 7 with 18 points. Alonso with 16 points, who just continues to be a galvanized driver.
Mm-hmm.
Always in the right place at the right time. Qualifies well. Finishes decently.
Yeah.
Just that speaks to his skill, I think. I mean, he's in an Aston.
Mm-hmm.
And just
steady points.
Steady points for him. So Stroll is ninth with 9 points. And then Lewis Hamilton, number 10, with 8 points. I think, you know, for me, looking at this table right now, I see McLaren creeping potentially above the Mercedes cars at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've already got two above the Mercedes cars, but it's early, and I guess we'll kind of see where that goes.
Yeah. If it's me talking, I think McLaren are in great position to finish third. I mean, you have a 29-point gap, of course, three races in, but I don't see anything from Mercedes that makes me believe they're going to be better than McLaren this year.
Well, they're a little bit of a lame duck. Hamilton, obviously, he's not really feeling it.
It doesn't seem like it.
Point. Doesn't seem like it. Drivers will do whatever they can to win. But they just don't seem to be competitive. He seems kind of lackadaisical in the first three GPs, just kind of, the car sucks. I'll just hang out. You know, I'm not going to push anything. I've got to worry about what I'm going to do next year.
Yeah, but for sure.
That's kind of what makes it interesting, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Constructor standings, I guess we'll get into real quick here before we take our quiz. We've got Red Bull on the top of the chart here at 97 points. Ferrari just 4 points behind at 93. And then McLaren, 55 points. So the deficit between 2 and 3 is pretty large.
Yeah.
Mercedes number 4 with 26 points, and Aston Martin 5th with 25 points. So 1 point differential there, and then it just goes into the shitter with Red Bull, the RB team, 6 points, and then 4 for Haas, and then everyone else has a 0. But as we mentioned earlier, good for Haas, and just let's keep it up, fellas. Let's just get let's try to get a couple points in each GP. Let's try to finish 10th or higher.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, at the end of the season, love to see them above the Alpines and the Williams of the world.
Yeah, we will have to see, but I feel pretty good. I think they're in a good spot at the moment. So there you go. There's your Australia recap. One we will probably look back on pretty fondly this season. So I guess it's quiz time here. So I'm ready for this one.
Yeah, let's just, okay. Computerization here. Quiz. Here we go.
Did not study, so going in blind.
All right. Well, I have a question here, so I guess we'll just click on this and see what happens. Which team's tally did Red Bull match? And now we're apparently we're at Bahrain and not Australia. So which team's win tally did Red Bull match with a victory in Bahrain? Williams, McLaren, Mercedes, or Lotus?
I don't even know if I understand what's being asked.
This might be a shuttle on here.
Which team's tally? Oh, like ever? Like in a season? Season tally? Is that what they're asking?
It just says which team's tally did Red Bull match with the victory in Bahrain?
Oh, like all-time wins maybe?
Possibly.
What were the options?
Williams, McLaren, Mercedes, Lotus. I'm going to say Mercedes.
I think Mercedes have a lot of wins. I'm going to go with Williams. No. Red Bull definitely has more wins than Williams. Maybe it is Mercedes. Give it a whirl.
Okay, this is going to be a little bit too arduous of a task, I think.
I think we might have to give this one a hook.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
Thought we'd give it a shot, but yeah, a little bit too much going on here with the old laptop, it seems like.
Which never really seems to be functioning at a high level when we need it to.
Exactly. All right, well, maybe I'll prepare a little bit better next time for this particular segment. But with that, I think 40 minutes in, we can shuttle the F1 talk.
Yeah. All right. So the quiz did not go to plan. I'll probably just take out that entire chunk. So not a big deal. So let's go ahead and move on and shift gears here into some soccer talk. And it was the arduous task of the international break, which always seems to happen right when club soccer is getting really good. Of course, last week, if you tuned into the program, you will have known and gotten up to date on all of your league tables. Of course, that hasn't changed at all because none of the clubs have played since then. But we get back into that action this weekend, so looking forward to that. But the United States men's national team had business to take care of in the CONCACAF Nations League. That is a tournament designed basically to have more competitive games for international teams in the North American region. It's in its third iteration. And the United States and Mexico once again met in the final for the second time of three asks here. Not your first rodeo with USA Mexico, I know that. Obviously not mine. This is a rivalry that has completely turned on its head in recent years. So in my formative years of watching the United States men's national team, you played Mexico, you hoped for the best, and then it usually ended in pain and suffering if you are inclined to be a United States fan. Not so much anymore. So this game, Matt, marks what will be 3 years since the United States has lost to Mexico in any form. Richard, how you doing? Sniffing around.
Executive D, Richard. Yep.
always making his presence felt. Anyways, yeah, so the United States pretty much own this rivalry now. And you can kind of just feel it by watching these matches now. They just play with a certain swagger against Mexico that they didn't always have. So it is very, very, very refreshing from that perspective. And I have to say, I think it's all but pretty much locked in that the United States is the best team in the region now. No real close competition, if you ask me. Mexico probably your closest, which is huge going into this summer where we are hosting the Copa America, which is going to have all of your best teams from South America, and it's going to be huge, so I can't wait for that. But let's get into the discussion here of this one. Big final on the line in Arlington, Texas, which means that's going to be a partisan Mexico crowd to be expected. Lineups in terms of both teams, really, kind of what we expected. Nothing really all that surprising from Greg Berhalter. Haji Wright gets the start at striker after scoring two goals against Jamaica. Gio Reyna, who ended up having a great game, starts as well. Mexico pretty much par for the course from what you would expect from them as well. And I would say right off the bat, you know, I felt like the U.S. controlled the game and were pretty comfortable throughout. Don't know if you shared that opinion or not, but that's the way I was seeing things, at least at the start.
Yeah, agreed. And, you know, we had a really good sequence around the fifth minute where it kind of showed where what this offense was going to, how they were going to play. Mm-hmm. Led by Pulisic, didn't end up with a goal in this particular sequence, but just really good ball handling. I felt like if they continued to play with that kind of attention and having guys in the box where they need guys in the box, I thought, okay, well, this should be a pretty good match. And it turned out to be just that.
Yeah.
A lot of opportunities were blown, I felt like, in the first half of this game.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really see a whole lot of, I don't know, action, I guess, until close to the end of the first half of this game. The 27th minute, McKennie, I mean, there was a lot of potential for scoring that didn't happen.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's always kind of been the Achilles heel of the United States, is there's no real deadly striker who is just going to bag goals for us whenever we need him to. You can see that from time to time because we create good chances often, but we don't always have that guy that can finish them. So, you know, McKennie has a damn good opportunity there, but he's just not a guy that's going to finish off chances like that. He's more of a facilitator, more of your box to box, throwing in tackles and doing some dirty work kind of guy.
I appreciated the officiating of this game. I thought it was well called.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, sometimes the officials can get in the way of a good game.
Yeah.
Not so with this one. I thought it was well called. They let him play, basically.
Yeah.
Which I always enjoy a match where, you know, that happens versus just ticky-tack, yellow card.
It was really refreshing to watch just because a lot of times in this matchup, the referee does one of two things. Either goes way too strict – and basically every foul is a yellow card, and trying to manage the game so it doesn't get out of hand, because, you know, we've seen these two teams get into some altercations, shall we say, since we've started the podcast. And you have that where it's like, okay, now it's just getting silly. You know, every foul is not a yellow card, but
yeah. And it turns out that the fan base would alter the end of this match. We'll get to that.
Yeah, we will have later to spend time on that, unfortunately, because that
30. Yeah, that, but, I was kind of not prepared for that particular incident. Didn't know that was the thing, but we'll get to that in the second half. 38th minute, Dest takes a really sweet long shot, goes high over the bar, but foreboding long shot as to what was to come here.
Yeah, I just want to highlight Dest, Sergiño Dest, for a second. A little bit of a liability defensively as our right back, but good God, can he get up the pitch? And he was genuinely, there were times he was making the Mexico defenders look stupid. He put them on skates on a number of different occasions. He is just so silky with that ball. And the U.S. historically are not a team that have great technical players like that, so it's really nice when you have guys like Dest, Gio Reyna, and we saw it from Pulisic in the second goal, just silky smooth moves to really bust open the Mexico defense. So very refreshing to see that.
I kind of felt like Wea was not given enough opportunity in the first half.
Yeah.
I think they played more to the right side than the left side.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 45th minute, of all people, an injured or pre-injured Adams.
Yeah.
Just a absolute banger from nearly mid pitch.
Yeah, so
a rifle shot.
Yeah, you felt like a goal was coming, but I did not expect it to be like that. Tyler Adams, yeah, like you said, coming off of injury, he'd only played one match for AFC Bournemouth in recent years or recent months. So he was actually on managed minutes because he comes off right at the beginning of the second half. So he was only ever going to play one half, which is ballsy from Greg Berhalter to start a guy in your midfield who's going to be so important, but you know can only go half the game. But good God, did it pay off. So, you know, he gets that opportunity. The ball is passed over to him, and it was weird because no one was around him. Mexico were more dug back. And look, realistically, Tyler Adams, 9 times out of 10, not really a threat from that deep, nor is really anyone. But I remember watching, I was watching with my friends, and he got the ball, and you'll hear it sometimes in crowds. They'll get the shoot thing going, right? So I yelled that kind of just as a joke, but then he just smashed the shit out of the ball and it was just perfectly struck and it went in. And I couldn't even believe my eyes. I think that's the best U.S. men's national team goal I've seen just from a pure fundamental standpoint. You know, importance and other stuff, maybe not, but just from a pure strike, that is probably the best goal I've seen since I've started watching.
And the importance of going into the half up one goal in this particular fixture was pretty substantial. So with that being said, we'll go to the second half, and Weah finally gets in the 50th minute a shot.
And yeah.
Just a great save by the Mexican goalkeeper.
Yeah, Memo Ochoa.
Yeah, but could have potentially been 2-0 with just 5 minutes into the second half, but didn't quite happen that way. In the 55th minute, there was a free kick where Pulisic had a really good opportunity and just could not break the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He tried to bend it around the right side, and it was immediately blocked.
It was one of those nights for Pulisic where he was getting into good spaces, creating good opportunities, but never got like his definitive moment, which he usually gets against Mexico. But yeah, that he's not, I don't think he's a particularly great set piece taker. I would love to see someone else give that a try for our team, but yeah, another one kind of just fired into the right into the wall there. And it's funny because with these matches, it's usually a back and forth affair, at least a little bit. I can point to one real Mexico opportunity, and that was Henry Martin. Basically, Dest is cooked defensively, which again, I still think he's a bit of a liability. And Henry Martin at least should be putting this shot on goal and kind of inexplicably completely misses that near post.
Yeah, blows the shot completely and had every opportunity.
Yeah.
Looked a little bit sad-footed, I guess. just could not connect. That was their shot. That was their chance to equalize this game and just did not happen.
Yeah. So that, honestly, I think that is the only time I was like, oh, geez, that was not a very good moment from the U.S. But other than that, I mean, I think it was a super comprehensive performance. This, and we'll talk about the Gio Reyna goal here in a sec, but this is a team that no longer really has any sort of fear when playing Mexico like there used to be. They just go in with a certain swagger against this team. And honestly, I'm, you know, looking at both lineups at this moment, I favor just about every position to the United States over Mexico, which is in the history of this rivalry has never, ever been the case. So you have to feel pretty good about it there, but sort of the icing on the cake, and then you knew it was pretty much over, and it basically was. Gio Reyna gets his goal, well-deserved, from Pulisic squares the ball after chipping it over a defender, and then his initial cross is cleared, but then it falls right to Gio Reyna, who just one-times it home, and what a well-taken goal there.
Yeah, so the ball rattled around in the box a bit, which I actually leapt off the couch as that ball was kind of pinballing around in the box.
Uh-huh.
And it was sweet.
Yeah.
I mean, it was Reyna was right there, and it was kind of the ball rattled a bit between a couple of different players, and then just a really nice shot for a 2-0 2-0 score, and then I guess that's when the fan base decided to pretty much shit on this match.
So this is not new for me, at least, because this happens just about every time we play Mexico. You would have noticed, I think, after the Reyna goal, them throwing shit at him, but I mean, that is pretty much par for the course. But yeah, so basically, here's what happens. every time the opposing goalkeeper, so whoever Mexico is playing against, takes a goal kick, they basically in unison yell what most people would agree is some sort of slur, of whether it be just generally offensive or have homophobic undertones, whatever. I'm not someone that is a Spanish linguist, so I'm not going to just assign meaning to it that I don't really know, but I think it's generally seen as offensive. And they do this every single time. And usually the first few times it happens, nothing is said about it or they don't do anything. And then it gets to the point where CONCACAF, the federation, feels the need to do something about it, and they drafted up this stupid fucking protocol that they have where the first time the players, the match is stopped, and then it's supposed to be the second time it's prolonged stop, and then the third time the match is just supposed to end. Well, we stopped twice and then just kept going. And this happens like every single time we play Mexico.
So, and it, this was all new to me, but I did my diligence as I watched this match. And I think the only failure for officiating was not halting the match, as per the 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
The league says, 1, we're going to do this. 2, we're going to do this. 3, match is finished.
Yeah.
And this one ended up +6 stoppage. And then during that +6 stoppage, they paused the match again.
Yeah.
And when they should have just called it, they should have just said, okay, if you assholes in the seats can't shut the fuck up,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's over.
Yeah. It's totally toothless, because you know they're not going to abandon the match. And I don't know what the fix is, because there's people that go, well, this is what we've always done and we don't see a problem with it. And then there's other people that, you know, they don't tolerate it. And then you just have the shit show going on the pitch where it's like, well,
you can't have a globally televised soccer match mm-hmm. where people are shouting horrible things
yeah.
in the background.
Yeah.
It just doesn't, it's not a good look for the mm-hmm. league. It's not a good look for soccer. It's not a good look, period.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly enough, kind of a dark pitch or dark shadow over what should have been a really good match for USA. I think it still was, but it just kind of, you know, it was like
it leaves a sour taste. Leaves a sour taste.
Yeah, a little bit. Little bit. So I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, the fans of the Mexico team are X or Y, but, mm-hmm. you know, come on, guys.
Yeah. That's kind of just how it's been and never really seems to change. It used to really piss me off, because they would do it and we would be losing, but now we absolutely dominate this rivalry, so I don't really care. They can do whatever they want. But basically, that's the last time you're going to see the U.S. play a competitive match with any real stakes until Copa America, which is going to be huge. That's hosted here in the United States this summer. Now, again, historically, that is your tournament that crowns the best international team in South America. But this time, some CONCACAF opponents are involved. And of course, it's in the United States. So that kicks off in June sometime, I think. And we'll see what the United States can do. I mean, obviously, you know, you have Argentina and Brazil involved, so you would favor those two. But I think the United States can make a pretty big splash in that tournament, and I think people expect them to. So that one is going to be really exciting in the summer. Can't wait for that, and we'll see what they can do. That's going to be, you know, that's that first big step towards 2026, where, of course, the United States are hosting the granddaddy of them all, the World Cup. So it is going to be a pretty exciting next 2 years for the United States, hopefully. So just a little bit of a kickoff here, little icing on the cake for a win and a trophy collected against Mexico. So I think that pretty much does it here. We do have some great club soccer back this weekend. Man City and Arsenal are playing. Obviously, huge Premier League title implications there. We will also, I would imagine, cover Celtic's trip to Livingston as we, you know, approach the business end of the Scottish Premiership season as well. So lots going on. Down week for F1, but always stories coming out of the paddock there. So should be a good one next time out as well.
Yeah. So we'll preview Japan next week, which is our fourth GP of the year. And tackling the chicane, will be traveling to South Bend in July.
Yeah.
To see Celtic play at Notre Dame Stadium. So
that is
looking forward to that. And we'll have
huge.
Yeah, much to talk about coming up.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, I think that is a show. So we'll go ahead and get out of here. Let's go guards. 10:07 first pitch, West Coast swing.
Yes, and I will be asleep. So hopefully they can pull off a victory for game number one.
Yep.
There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into.
For executive producers, Richard Tanaka.
There's an oil.
This has been Tackling the Chicane.
Down the Cuyahoga River.
We'll see you guys next time.
Rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil bar that's waiting down the path.